May it please the Court, I'm Ann McClintock, Assistant Federal Defender, on behalf of Mr. Richmond, the appellant. I'm most interested in answering whatever questions the Court has. I want to start just very briefly regarding the procedural bar. I'm assuming if there are any questions, I'll get asked. I stick with the notion that it was not raised. The Court issued an order seeking supplemental excerpts, which we provided. I think there are a variety of answers to, and I did provide the Court with a 28-J letter a week and a half ago, which I hope the panel got one nod. Essentially, my position regarding the procedural bar is the two claims that we have, the two areas on appeal have nothing to do with the claims that were raised in the California Supreme Court decision that relied on In re Waltrius and In re Dixon. So there's no application of a bar. But in any case, it shouldn't even be raised, given what this Court in Vang has held is about the proper posture for raising that sua sponte. So I'm going to leave that alone unless there are questions. This case, I think, it's another case that's come up as a pro se litigant in district court.
Before we leave the procedural default issue, I take it that the state didn't raise procedural default in the district court?
No, they did not.
All right.
They did not raise it in the briefing either. So it was first I heard of it was when the Court issued its order. There are two claims that we've presented on appeal. One has to do with ineffective assistance by trial counsel, and the other has to do with, I just drew a blank on how I phrased it, the exclusion of impeachment evidence regarding Officer Barnett. I want to focus for a little bit on the first one because I think that's where the significant factual dispute exists in the record that was not resolved adequately by the magistrate judge and then adopted by the district court. And as much as I sympathize with the magistrate judge, because this is a difficult case as far as distance and organization of the petition, it's a very long petition. It is organized after a fashion, but it is not obvious when you delve into it exactly where his factual claims are and where the support for it is. But the two basic and fundamental errors that the magistrate judge made in dealing with the ineffective assistance counsel claim was to say that Mr. Richmond had provided bald assurances and no support. And in fact, he provided his declaration, which is at excerpts of record tab 1, 122 and 123, where he explains a verified declaration is his mind. So he thinks he's sworn under oath. I don't know whether it satisfies the specific requirements, but I think it does, that his trial attorney essentially told him, you have no choice but to get up there and say you didn't have a gun and you didn't assault anyone. And it's on you to do that. And when Mr. Richmond said, no, I don't want to do that, I want the truth to come out. I want Miss Norgar, I've never had to actually say it out loud, testify because she can attest to my innocence as to the assault with a deadly weapon charge. And there, the ineffective assistance claim interwines with the whole notion that a defendant has a personal right to decide whether to go to trial. A defendant has a personal right whether to decide to testify or to...
On Norgard, didn't trial counsel have a letter from Norgard's attorney saying that if she was called, she would say that your client did have a gun?
I'm trying to think of the record regarding a letter. There is the allegation that Mr. Richmond admits that her testimony, that she told his trial attorney that she says essentially, I know he didn't have the gun when he went to the truck because I took it away from him. So it does implicate him on the felon in possession charge. I agree with that. I don't know whether the record has that actual letter in it, so I hesitated only to try to remember that. But I don't remember.
If he had the gun at that point in time, he's bingo on the third strikes, isn't he?
He's got problems on the felon possession. He already had problems on the felon possession, and that does yes, you're smiling. It does trigger three strikes. My response to that is where I got into the Sixth Amendment problem, is that I view that truly as the defendant's decision. There is a conflict between what is the realm of a defense attorney's role in deciding strategy in a case and the decision of a defendant to waive, basically to enter a slow guilty plea is the way I view this. And what he's contesting, and this is the thing that I think needs to be developed better in district court and sorted out, what's the truth and what was the strategy and what whether Mr. Richmond actually acquiesced to the advice he was given or whether he was just overshod by his trial attorney, is what he's alleging in his petition, and again, it's a pro per petition, is that I wanted the truth to come out. Yes, that may hang me on the felon in possession. Now, there are many consequences. A felon in possession conviction is not a
crime. But is it your position that he had the right to determine who got called as a witness?
Not who got called the witness per se. That is strategy. The case law says that that's for the defense, the trial attorney to decide. But he has the decision as to whether to plead guilty or not. So when there's a conflict that involves that witness decision that conflicts with his decision to plead guilty to one of the counts, I mean, he has the right to plead guilty to count two. If he wanted to get up there and basically say, I was guilty of the felon in possession. I mean, I picked it up at the – because in the testimony, there's testimony about him having a gun in various times, not just in connection with the assault with a deadly weapon. So it's my position that he had the right to risk it of being convicted on the felon in possession in order to have the truth come out on the thing he said he was actually factually innocent of, which was the assault with a deadly weapon. Now, that can have a significant impact on his sentence now. I mean, his view of it – this is outside the record, so I don't know if I – to deal with it. But a felon in possession is not a crime of violence. It's a status offense. Assault with a deadly weapon certainly is a crime of violence. So when he comes up for parole, should he live long enough? And actually, I think the record is clear in our briefing that his sentence was reduced to 35 years to life, not 60. But when he gets to parole, if he's still alive, the view that the Board of Prison Terms is going to have of him is significantly different if they view him as a violent felon or as a status felon doing life term. So that can have a consequence. So my view of this case, with a fundamental problem with it, is that conflict between him wanting to risk conviction on one count in order to avoid conviction he hopes his best chance is avoiding conviction on the count that he is actually innocent of.
Let's back up a little bit.
Sure.
On this witness claim, his claim is that his counsel should have called Norgaard and Haight, right?
Correct.
This is not a case where we have an affidavit from either of them.
Not directly. It is a case where we have some representations as to what their testimony would have been.
We don't have an affidavit and we don't have any sworn testimony from either of them. What we do have is the letter that I referred to that would have made him put him in possession with a gun at some point. That's Norgaard.
Right. That's the letter from Mr. Bisno, I believe, which is Mr. Richardson's appellate attorney.
And there was testimony at the trial from a witness named George that Haight didn't witness this incident at all.
That's true, but Mr. Haight's testimony...
So what the,
go ahead.
What the magistrate and the district court had in front of them is an assertion that these two witnesses would have helped your client in some respect. No affidavit, no sworn testimony, but a letter saying... had a gun and a witness who said this Haight person didn't witness the crime at all. So where's the error in the district court concluding as it did?
Well, there's no sworn testimony directly from Ms. Norgaard or Mr. Haight. There is sworn testimony from Mr. Richmond as to what his understanding, what they would have said based on his conversations with his trial attorney and the letters from Mr. Bisno. So I think there is a factual dispute even within the letters from Mr. Bisno and what Mr. Richmond says.
Well, Mr. Richmond in his affidavit says Haight could have witnessed the events. He doesn't say he did. He could have. Other witnesses place that other witness about a mile or two away, don't they?
That's true. And yeah. I concede that as far as the assault with the deadly weapon part, Haight is a weaker witness. So if I found him tomorrow, I don't know what he would say, whether he would help them or not. Part of Mr. Richmond's complaint, though, regarding Haight also, though, was also that Haight would have provided supporting testimony to his defense, which was basically there's been this ongoing confrontation between this out-of-control minor and that his intentions regarding this whole group of people was to help Ms. Norgaard get her foster child under control and back at the home, away from these adult men who have shown up.
But why is this also fuzzy in the district court? Why wasn't it developed in state court?
Mr. Richmond tried his best, and there was no evidentiary hearing in the state court. It basically was summary denials across the board. There was, he tried, and that's part of the reason that the briefing, his pro se briefing, I think, is so long, is he's attaching exhibits that he has gathered as he's gone through. So he's presented what he could in the state courts, but the state courts never made any kind of merits or factual development decisions. So I don't recall.
He requested, in other words, he presented specific information to the state court and requested an evidentiary hearing and was specifically denied?
The latter question is no. There was, my memory of the minute orders is that there's just, they're denied on the merits, kind of very short California decisions. Whether he specifically requested evidentiary hearings, I can't say. I don't remember exactly what he had in the pro se petitions at each level. My position.
That's one of the predicates to getting an evidentiary hearing in federal court, is that he has to show a factual predicate that could not have been previously discovered through the exercise of due diligence.
Right, I want to acknowledge that I do know that my time is up, but I'd like to respond. That factual predicate and due diligence stuff, all of that is important and comes in when the other side has he doesn't have an opportunity to deal with this in state court when the order to show cause has been issued. And when the Superior Court or the Court of Appeals or the California Supreme Court just summarily deals with his petition, he's provided them with the evidence. As far as he knows, they're accepting what his factual assertions are and then denying it on some basis, some legal basis. So as far as while he's going through the state court process, he doesn't know that there's any factual findings that are being made against him. We don't know that.
So but there was no offer to the state court other than basically what was offered to the federal court.
As far as I can tell, yes. I don't know that he specifically filed a motion requesting an evidentiary.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Janine Bush on behalf of the respondent. I'd like to address a couple of the questions that the court just asked. The court should be aware that there was a colloquy on the record, the trial record at RT9 and again at RT20, where the trial court took an extensive waiver from the defendant about wanting to admit his felon status. There was commentary about the defense attorney having talked to the defendant about this whole issue, so these later affidavits are not necessarily reflective of what actually happened at the time. And the court should also be aware that this defendant filed a number of petitions in the lower courts. And one of the petitions filed in the lower courts was a petition for writ of habeas corpus in the Tehama court, and it's at Exhibit D in the exhibit to the answer, to respondent's answer. And that petition was prepared by an attorney. It was very extensive, and it was the basis for the reduction in the sentence, as a matter of fact. So there was certainly opportunity for a counsel to raise witness issues, IAC issues, whatever, because we had a whole new attorney doing a whole new petition. It was not pro se. I think possibly the most important thing to realize here in the question of whether or not the trial court was correct in its exercise of discretion in denying an evidentiary hearing is to realize that we don't even get to the point of talking about whether or not the defendant developed the facts in the state court until we first talk about whether or not the record contains a factual basis for the claims. And it's basically the first step in three steps in analyzing whether or not an evidentiary hearing is appropriate. Not mandated, but appropriate. So this first step is whether the record contains a factual basis for the claims. Basically, we stop right there because the record contradicts any factual basis for the claims. The record that is before the state courts and in turn before the district court. The justice has already noted, the judge has already noted now's letter, talked to the defendant about his conversation with, and she said. So, you know, who is an appointed attorney and whose duty he's doing his job and he's interviewing a witness and he's collusion. And that's certainly more of what Valora Norgaard would say that the defendant would. And the court's already pointed out the difficulties with Haight as a witness. And you basically are in a situation where the defendant says in an affidavit, we both heard and other record materials that show that there's here. The point of asking the question.
Why is there are witnesses, no doubt.
Well,
he says he didn't have a gun.
At what, right.
Is he entitled to an evidentiary hearing?
No, Your Honor, because in the jurisprudence around evidentiary hearings, its conclusions properly implied in Lonberger. And when the state fails to make explicit a claim for writ habeas corpus with sentence, no. Or factual conclusions. In the denial of the claim has resolved all on the claim. So whether or not you have and then all this other record evidence saying not is what the state went with finding. You that in conjunction with federal courts must infer that the state and that's again at Marshall Campbell versus Vaughn. Situation where there isn't anything to review. Basically, the state court had made an unreasonable application of the law to this. That's not the evidentiary hearing. And I do want to point out to the since the filing of our the come out with Lockyer that has knocked out the Vantran standard of reviewing a state's decision under the clearly less favorable. The Supreme Court stated that we unreasonableness, and that gives broader courts. The findings and recommendations here are under the Vantran standard. To note that.
You don't think even after there. Back to the Ninth Circuit's approach as a screen. In other words, if there's any merit to it.
Say that was a and it was one methodology over other over another brief made by the federal courts. That question of which is preposterous or something like that. So it's a good thing to look at the precedent of Ninth Circuit, but other and this courts of its own to do. I mean, if other people have come to the same conclusions, are reasonable.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right.
Regarding the exhibit D, point out regarding that is if Mr. problems that he was having and that there were others. He was trying to get this retained habeas counsel to raise, and that was the fodder of his ineffective claim regarding that. I think the fact means anything to the court. That the Attorney General made regarding direct appeal. And I would just point out that I think that is the case. Something I've briefed in my dealing with state. They're not always on the lookout. And as the Supreme Court said,
it was claimed, but it was this
session in the 2255 context, habeas claims, especially in effective assistance counsel claims, are not fodder for direct appeal. It's not the proper posture.
It's
at the habeas stage.
So
I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. The case just argued will be submitted. We'll move to the last case on the argument calendar for today, Cisco against Husky. And the last case, which shows on the base sheet, Anthony against McGrath, has been submitted on the briefs. You found that one.
Thank you. We'll find him.
I didn't think you'd have any arguments. I think that case is in the record for excerpts.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. Watch the clock then.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Frank Prantill. I represent Mr. Cisco, who's been sentenced to prison for the rest